I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. This hour, we dig deep into the economic system of slavery, how it was different in the U.S. than other parts of the world, and how, by treating enslaved people as economic assets as well as labor, slavery counted on black women bearing multiple children, essentially breeding people. Children were interest on the investment. Maryland and Virginia played a special role in breeding slaves and selling them south. It's laid out in great detail in a sobering new analysis titled The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. We'll talk to its authors, Constance and Ned Sublette, and to you after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Interesting topic today. Very glad that you are with us for it. In the racial tensions of recent months, especially here in Baltimore, the thoughts of writer Ta-Nehisi Coates about the black body as the target of racism have caught the attention of many people. We're going to spend this hour discussing research that illuminates the history behind America's connection with slaves and, in particular, with their bodies. The book is titled The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. Its central thesis is that in America, enslaved people were not just labor, they were also capital. Their black bodies were an investment by those who owned them, a way of storing value, like a bank account. In such a system, the birth of a child was not so much the arrival of an individual with God-given potential, but a payment of interest, an economic asset. As the authors write on their first page, the system, quote, ensured a steady flow of saleable human product from the wombs of women who had no legal right to say no, close quote. It's a sobering book and a serious conversation, and I hope you'll be part of it. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us 410-662-8780 is our number, or toll free 1-866-661-9309. The authors of The American Slave Coast are joining us from Washington College in Chestertown, where the first parts of this book were written at the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of American Life. They are a husband and wife team, Constance Sublette, whose previous work as a novelist is under the name Constance Ash, and Ned Sublette, who has written several histories and is also a musician. For years, he produced Afropop Worldwide on NPR. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yes, it is.
It's great to have you with us. And Constance, I'd like to start with something that I read that you said. I did not see it in the book itself, but it stuck with me from an interview you gave, that as bad as we think slavery was, the reality was worse. What in particular prompted you to say that?
I began looking at these matters without being as serious as it became fairly early in the 1980s. Then when we came to Chestertown and began researching what was going to be the American Slave Coast, the more deeply I studied the matters, and as we progressed through the history of the United States from the colonial era into emancipation during the Civil War, what I learned about the process of slavery, about how women in particular were so central to this, I kept learning about new tortures, new coercions, new tragedies of families being broken up, and I just never came to the end of how terrible it was, because I would learn something new that was more terrible than the last thing I had learned.
Ned Sublette, how would you edit or expand my description of your central thesis?
I thought you did a great job of summarizing it. It's what we tried to do in this book was basically write a history of the United States from earliest colonial times up through emancipation as seen from the point of view of the slave breeding industry. And when we say the slave breeding industry, really what we mean is American slavery, because people were financialized from the earliest moments that we have records of. And it was a different system than existed in the rest of the hemisphere. In the rest of the hemisphere, in the Spanish and French territories, the crop was primarily sugar, and sugar killed workers off fast. The logic of capitalism required that they be worked to death rather than have more workers. It was cheaper to have fewer workers and work them twice as hard and replace them with fresh arrivals from Africa within 8 to 10 years, so that these cultures were being continually refreshed with new infusions of Africans. In the Chesapeake, it was very different because an unprecedented phenomenon in the hemisphere, with the relatively milder work of tobacco, relatively milder climate, fewer diseases, better food, and closer to gender parity, the enslaved did not die off, but rather grew, the enslaved population. So the conditions existed to have a slave breeding industry in the Chesapeake that did not exist anywhere else. Now, people were being financialized from early on, but it didn't really become an industry as such until after the War of 1812. At this point, it was long established that people were money. That's for starters. It goes on.
Yeah, and we have the time this hour to get into a lot of that. I'd like to start actually where you start the book. You begin with a very detailed look at a coffle. What is a coffle?
Yeah, we found that many people don't know this word, and so we begin by discussing what a coffle was to make sure we're all on the same page, so to speak. A coffle was, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, a train of men or beasts, a chain gang, in short. And the coffle was the major mode of transportation for the grand forced migration of enslaved people from the Upper South to the Lower South. The largest number of people who were trafficked from the Chesapeake and subsequently other territories down south were sent overland in coffles, but they were sent by every other means as well. The word coffle comes from the Arabic kafila, referring to the overland coffles in Africa that crossed the Sahara Desert to feed the Islamic slave trade, which existed long before Columbus crossed the Atlantic. But in the United States, and even before in the colonial years, coffles took people down in groups of 100 was a very large one, and they would take about 5 weeks maybe to get from Upper South to Lower South, covering 20 to 25 miles on foot every day, in rain, whatever the weather was, sleeping on the ground, sleeping in tents, in chains, often the women sometimes tied with rope, the men with iron. Watched over by whip and gun-wielding guards.
Tied with iron means they had collars around their necks.
They had iron collars around their necks. They had cuffs around their hands. They were, Lewis Hughes' description, sorry, Charles Ball's description says, a strong iron collar was closely fitted by means of a padlock round each of our necks. A chain of iron about 100 feet in length was passed through the hasp of each padlock, except at the two ends where the hasps of the padlocks passed through a link of the chain. In addition to this, we were handcuffed in pairs with iron staples and bolts, with a short chain about a foot long uniting the handcuffs and their wearers in pairs. In that condition, they walked all the way from Virginia to Mississippi.
I'm gathering, since you're reading, that you have a copy of the book there with you, and I was wondering whether Constance could read to us the last paragraph on page 5 about the coffle and who was in it.
Perhaps 80% of enslaved children were born to two-parent families, though the mother and father might live on different plantations. But in extant slave traders' records of those sold, according to Michael Tadman's analysis, complete nuclear families were almost totally absent. About a quarter of those trafficked southward were children between 8 and 15, purchased away from their families. The majority of coffle prisoners were male, boys who would never again see their mothers, men who would never again see wives and children. But there were women and girls in the coffle, too, exposed as were enslaved women everywhere, to the possibility of sexual violation from their captors. The only age bracket in which females outnumbered males in the trade was 12 to 15, when they were as able as boys to do the field labor, and they could also bear children. And that's the key.
And so tell me why you decided to start the book there, in a coffle, and give us all those images right off the bat.
Because the transportation, the trafficking, was central to the whole operation. It moved a vast number of people from one part of the country to another, remaking American culture in the process. It seemed like such a central image that I think everyone can very readily understand. The economic argument is a little complicated, but I think everybody can readily grasp what it means to have 100 people in chains force-marched from Virginia to Mississippi. And also, I think it's just important to know that this happened. There were other means of transportation. The coffle was the cheapest. Many people were sent in ocean-going ships around Florida to the Gulf. More slave ships came to New Orleans from the east coast of the U.S. than from Africa. So that's where the title, The American Slave Coast, comes from. They were sent by rail. Once there were railroads, they were sent by flatboat. Every way you could traffic people, they were trafficked. But the fundamental means of trafficking people was the coffle.
That's Ned Sublett here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. Ned and his wife Constance Sublett, who is also with us, have written The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. You can be part of this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wipr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. You write that slaves from Maryland and Virginia commanded a premium. You mentioned earlier, Ned, that slaves in the Chesapeake lived longer than in much of the rest of the hemisphere. Why a premium on Chesapeake slaves?
They were considered, it was a branding, basically. They were considered to be good workers. They were, because they were domestically raised, bear in mind, in the earliest days of this industry, the Chesapeake was the only major supplier. Gradually, Kentucky got in on it, Tennessee got in on it. As new territories converted from being slave importing states or colonies to being slave exporters, the slave exporting territory moved farther south. But in the earliest days,
in the earliest days, there were already very fine family networks of enslaved people in the Upper Chesapeake, and they had learned English. They were Protestant in religion, although they also practiced still traditional African forms of spirituality, and they knew how to do the work. They did not need to be trained. Or at least in the minds of the people who were trafficking them down south and the people who would then be purchasing them for their own labor force, they were presumed to be docile, not at all like imported Africans. And with all of this training and that they did not have to learn a new language, they were considered to be a premium product. And this remained the case all the way through up until emancipation.
Thank you, Constance. I choked on my sip of water.
You're okay now.
That's right. They were considered to be docile. That was a very important point, because there was tremendous fear, especially after the Haitian Revolution, of so-called French Negroes coming in, bringing the virus of revolution, or of Africans who had military training and fought in gun-toting armies in Africa. But African Americans were kept carefully away from military training. We're kept carefully away from learning the use of weapons and tactics so that they were considered to be safer.
We are going to take a short break here. We're speaking with Constance and Ned Sublette, the authors of The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. What questions do you have for them about how slavery unfolded here in Maryland? Or is any of this surprising you, what we're hearing in this discussion? You can call us, 410-662-8780. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about a new history by Ned and Constance Sublette called The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. You can be part of the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. We also have a toll-free line. That's 866-661-9309. We'd love to hear from you. Ned, how did you come to write this book? What was the beginning of it?
I think the real beginning of it was very long ago when I was in grade school in the South and was told lies in school. I think that's really where the seed was planted that would become this book. But
what lies in particular?
Oh, my gosh. Let's just say I went to a segregated school in Louisiana where the teacher told us not to put coins in our mouth because they might have been in the hands of a sick person. Might have been in the hands of a colored person, that, you know, the Civil War wasn't really about slavery. The boilerplate lies that one gets. If you went to school in Virginia at that time, people who were in seventh grade in Virginia in 1957 had a state-mandated textbook that said something like, life for the Negroes in slavery days in Virginia was generally happy. The Negroes went about in a cheerful manner, making a living for themselves and for those for whom they worked. Complete soft-peddling of slavery. And this continues into our present time. The recent furor over the textbook in Texas, the McGraw-Hill textbook, that everyone seems to have heard about this now, that said that the African slave trade brought millions of workers, quote, from Africa to the southern United States to work on agricultural plantations. And most of the furor about this has focused on the inappropriateness of the word workers, but hardly anyone has mentioned, except for Melissa Harris Perry, hardly anyone has mentioned that the statement itself is a lie because millions were not brought to the northern part of America, to the present-day United States. Best numbers, 389,000. Millions of Africans did not work on the plantations. They're still telling kids this. And that's a terrible lie to tell. First of all, it sanitizes slavery in its own way by erasing the slave breeding industry. In 2008, I wrote a book called The World That Made New Orleans, which has a chapter called The Slave Breeding Industry, where I laid some of this out in short form, but it seemed to me that the story was so much bigger than I could give it in that book that it seemed necessary to expand it, and that, furthermore, one could tell the whole history of the United States from this point of view.
And that is indeed what you have done in this very massive book, almost 700 pages. But your point on the numbers is that the best numbers we can figure for the number of slaves imported is less than 400,000, and yet by the time of emancipation, there were 4 million enslaved people in the
right.
United States. So there was a lot of growth going on.
And somebody made money on the birth of every one of those 4 million enslaved people, and on the birth of their parents, and quite possibly on the birth of their grandparents. Every enslaved child was worth, depending on the place and time, $75 or $100 at birth, which meant not that they were going to be sold immediately for that sum of money, but that the person who owned them had that much more credit from the bank or the larger slaveholder or whoever he got a mortgage from, that there was more credit because there was more collateral. And as the enslaved child got older, there was yet more credit, more collateral, until they reach their peak value at the age of about 17. So the growth to 4 million people was itself an economic expansion because people were money in the slaveholding South.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, Ned, something that happened around the time of the War of 1812. It was in 1808, correct, that the United States banned the importation of slaves. Why was that significant?
That, I think, is one of the most important dates in American history, and hardly anybody knows it. It's a date that's in the Constitution, by the way. This was a major obstacle to unification at the Constitutional Convention, the issue of the African slave trade being allowed or prohibited. The big conflict, so to speak, that provides part of the drama of our book is Virginia, the slave breeding state with Maryland, in league with Maryland, versus South Carolina, the slave importing state in league with Georgia. There was a huge debate at the Constitutional Convention. The compromise at South Carolina's insistence was a 20-year guarantee for the protection of the African slave trade, which Virginia did not want to continue, and which South Carolina merchants wanted the ability to continue.
So Virginia did not want it to continue, essentially as a protectionist.
That's absolutely correct. When pursuant to President Thomas Jefferson's signature, the slave trade from Africa was shut off at the earliest constitutionally permissible date, January 1st, 1808. It was, on the face of it, a humanitarian action. Jefferson certainly portrayed it as such, but it was protectionism. It kept out the cheaper African imports so that Virginia and Maryland could sell their higher-priced, domestically raised human product with no competition.
We have an email from Vinny who asks essentially to go deeper into what we're talking about. Could you talk more, Vinny writes, could you talk more about the intersection between the rise of slavery and the growth of capitalism in the U.S.?
Ooh, that's a big one. Slavery was capitalism. Let's be real clear. There are some people who have portrayed slavery as a feudal system. It wasn't. It was capital. It was capitalism. Labor was capital.
I'd like to interrupt here to describe one of the major reasons that you cannot describe antebellum slavery as a feudal system. Because in the feudal system, serfs were not allowed to be alienated from the land, i.e. you could not sell them separately from the land. And in the whole European system of feudalism, which also included entail to the oldest inheritor of this land, the labor force had to go with the land. So therefore, they were protected to have at least communities. Families were not broken up. But here in the United States, our system was entirely different, as the labor force was classified in the legal system as chattel property, not real estate. And that is also what makes it very different from the way things happened in the systems under Spain and France.
This began very early on in Virginia, by the way. Investors felt much more comfortable investing in enslaved property, that is to say people, if they knew that they could seize the slaves for debt and from a debtor and resell them. The one exception in the United States was Louisiana, where slaves were still considered, according to the Latin model, to be inalienable from the plantations. But here, everywhere but Louisiana, slaves were separable from the land, and so they were sold into the new territories. Every child born—I'll say this again—every child born was, as Thomas Jefferson said, an addition to the capital. And I think Jefferson expressed it in a very concise way, how it worked. He said, in the letter written when he was, I think, 77 to his son-in-law, John Wales Epps, he wrote, "I know of no error more consuming to an estate than that of stocking farms with men almost exclusively." In other words, he's speaking of enslaved people as livestock. "I consider a woman who brings a child every 2 years as more productive than the best man of the farm. What she produces is an addition to the capital, whereas his labors disappear in mere consumption." And what he was saying with that was that the cash crops, the staples that a, quote, prime field hand, a laboring man would produce, whether they were cotton, tobacco, rice, sugar, whatever, generated cash flow, which could easily be frittered away. But the product of childbirth labor, a baby, was an addition to the permanent wealth of the estate because labor was capital. I don't know if that answered the question, Vinny.
Vinny joined us by email, so we can't get his reaction to that.
It's an infinite topic.
It is. It is, and very, very foundational to our country and our economy, so I'm glad we're talking about it. We're talking about The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry, written by Ned and Constance Sublette, who are joining us from Washington College in Chestertown here on Midday on WIPR. We'd like you to join us, too. We're taking your phone calls at 410-662-8780, or you, like Vinny did, you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org. A couple of things that follow from that. First of all, if women, as Thomas Jefferson lays out there, were so valuable in their role as breeders, what happened to women who couldn't bear children? What happened to older women after childbearing years? Constance?
Oh, when we talk about how the more you learn about slavery, the worse it turns out that it was, women who could not or would not reproduce would be punished or corrected in the case of refusing to reproduce, i.e., if the person who owned her told her to be with this man and she did not want to be with this man, she would be punished. And this would include what they call physical correction. And when she got...
Physical correction means?
It means being whipped.
Okay.
There are some descriptions of this in our book that are taken from slave narratives of people who witnessed these things, including some women who were also very resourceful and who managed to understand about certain things that they could eat that were available in their region, which would keep them from becoming pregnant. But they had been forced to be with a man that they didn't want to be with no matter what. And if it turns out that they were essentially barren, they would be sold. They would be sold away and sold down south, either going down by the river from Kentucky, which is like what we really mean by being sold down the river, as opposed to like from here in the Chesapeake down to New Orleans or wherever. But she would be sold and sent to much harsher plantation systems, with the new systems, the new plantations being opened up in the deeper south or on the killing factories that were the sugar plantations in Louisiana.
Being sold away was commonly considered to be the worst thing that could happen. And women, when they got older and unable to reproduce, as with men who got too old to work, were considered to be worthless. Their rations were often cut, or sometimes they were even given their freedom. That is to say, they were dumped with no place to go.
That's why that so many states made laws against slave owners manumitting, as they called it, their elderly slaves, to keep them from suddenly being vagrants in the road.
So we've been talking about this very sensitive issue of forced mating. And some people may be thinking, are we talking, are you alleging that there were stud farms like the novel Mandingo?
That's not how it worked. If we can imagine it, someone may have tried it, but there are all kinds of reasons that such a farm wouldn't work, and there's no mention of them in traders' letters, and if they had existed, they would have existed to supply traders. Scholars generally conclude that those kinds of stud farms did not really exist, perhaps on an experimental scale somewhere. It's hard to say something never happened, but that wasn't how the system worked. How the system worked was the traders' agents would fan out across the eastern shore of Maryland and across large parts of Virginia, go to every farm at the end of harvest time and say, what do you have for me? And the farmer could say, well, I could let you have this 16-year-old, I could let you have this 17-year-old. And after some time spent combing the area, and one could say harvesting young people, they would be brought in a coffle to Richmond, which was kind of a wholesale market for slaves who would then be shipped on farther down south.
Therese, I'm not sure where Therese is emailing us from. She asks, what happened to the children who were born to slaves that were disabled, as well as slaves that became disabled?
Well, unfortunately, in many cases, what happened to them was what happened to runts of animal species. They would be killed. That did happen. There is one famous exception, one of the most famous concert attractions, probably the second most famous concert attraction in the 19th century behind Louis Moreau Gottschalk, was the pianist Blind Tom from Georgia, who was severely autistic, had the, as an adult, had the mind of a six-year-old at best, was blind. Would probably not have survived childhood, except that he had this fantastic talent of being able to reproduce any music he heard on the piano and being able to reproduce any sound that he heard. It was said that he could hear a political speech and reproduce the entire thing without understanding it, but completely capture the sound of it and reproduce it. So he was a major concert attraction. Most disabled children were, of course, not as lucky.
We are talking about an era in which women in general died often in childbirth. Do we know anything from what evidence you've been able to scour, what the mortality rate was for enslaved women?
Don't have numbers.
We have quite a few people who want to join this conversation by email, and there are a couple of emails I'd like to put together. So what I'd like to do is take another break. We need to take a break soon here anyway. Give our other listeners who want to join this conversation a chance to send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. We still have some time with Constance and Ned Sublett, the authors of The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. You can join the conversation. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Ned Sublett and Constance Sublett. They're joining us from Washington College in Chestertown. That's where they started writing the book we're discussing, The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. And you can be part of this conversation. Share your thoughts with Ned and Constance Sublett at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. And quite a few people have done that. Actually, Julie tweeted at us. She said, would love to hear your guests about today's anti-choice laws targeting black women's reproduction as it relates to slave fertility. We also got an email from Bethany who asks, do you think or have there been studies that reflect the way slaves were bred during that time now contributing to today's African-American culture. And Julie in Baltimore wrote, quote, "What a staggeringly important book. It seems that there is a clear parallel between the profit that slave owners and merchants earned from slave breeding and present-day anti-abortion restrictions, which heavily burden poor women, often women of color, and undocumented women who are unable to access what should be legal abortion services. This is an effective way of keeping poor people poor, which certainly benefits those who own capital in our society. Can you discuss the parallel between the direct control of slave women's fertility and the present-day indirect control of poor women's fertility that takes place by denying access to contraception and abortion?" So I stack all those queries up for you to address. Constance or Ned?
That's a great deal of stacking, all right, and it covers so many centuries and history of the world, even. But yes, there has to be relationships among these eras and our conditions currently with the concerted efforts to deny reproductive choice and even reproduction health to particularly women of color and women who are not as well off as some others. It was a terrible time back then because, of course, we didn't have the methods that we have now. But for women of color who are working on the plantations, they also did not receive the kind of nourishment that is best for a successful pregnancy. They were also expected to be pregnant as soon as possible and as often as possible. And not everyone was as scientific about it as Thomas Jefferson, who believed that the breeding cycle should be at least every 2 years. And he probably learned that from his own wife, who died in childbirth, being pregnant even more often than every 2 years. Or I shouldn't say she didn't die in childbirth. She died as consequences of it. There is always been a reason that people want to control women's reproduction. It's either to make them have more babies or to have no babies. It isn't only about political control, but it is also about economic control. And as we know, with the era of slave breeding, with every child that was brought forth, the person who had title to that child, the wealth had increased. And why people want to keep... I want to backtrack just for a minute. One of the ways that the bodies of the women of color in that era were controlled is that the owner or his designated overseer or whomever could interfere in their lives at any time, which included going into their homes, such as they were at night, to be sure that they were cohabiting with a man to be producing children. And now it's another way of interfering with the body, as Denise Coates has talked about. And we have a very long tradition now because of our slavery system of still believing we have the right to interfere with the bodies of particularly African Americans and even more so with African American women, that we have the right to tell them what to do, when, and how.
I think that it's also important to realize that as bad as things are today, it's almost impossible for us to enter into the mindset of what it was like in slavery days. As Constance said, the more you learn about slavery, the worse it gets. It's hard to wrap one's mind around what it means to have no personhood at all. Enslaved women had no protection from sexual violation, either from white men or from other enslaved men. There was no, legally, no such thing as the rape of an enslaved woman. And for that matter, Virginia didn't recognize spousal rape as a crime until 1986.
We have an email here from an anonymous sender who says the following. I applaud the new attention this book brings, but would like your guests, you or your guests, to comment on their knowledge and the influence of previous scholarship, historical, sociological, anthropological, etc., by black scholars that have already addressed these same issues. Without such context, your attention to these writers unwittingly contributes to white savior narrative, wherein it is white scholars' work. The text is a little confused here. Wherein white scholars' work does not reference or acknowledge the scholarship of black writers who have researched and published on these issues. Would you like to comment on that?
We have 1,500 footnotes. Our book takes into account as much of the scholarship as we could possibly digest. There is so much that no one knows at all. And the major scholar, I think the one who really at first set me off studying this was not an African-American scholar, but was Frederick Bancroft, who in 1931 wrote a book that laid a lot of stuff out. Without Frederick Bancroft, there's much we wouldn't have known. Of course, the work of black scholars is important. The work of, you know, we've known about this. I mean, it's not like we're necessarily claiming that this is new. We have chosen to forget this, and we forget it over and over again. The term slave breeding was commonly in use in the 1850s. John Quincy Adams in his diary referred to John Tyler as the slave breeder. So this is not something we haven't known about. One of the major sources that we used in the book was, of course, the slave narratives and the thousands of oral history interview with enslaved people, the primary documentation that I think really lays out best what it was really like, the voices of the enslaved themselves. There are some critical questions about the quality of some of the oral history interviews, but in general, they're a fantastic collection that mutually reinforces a picture of slavery that is horrific.
That's Ned Sublette, one of the authors of The American Slave Coast, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Ned Sublette's wife and co-author, Constance Sublette, is also with us. And I should point out that the very first email that we received was from Melissa, who wrote us, my son is in the eighth grade in the Baltimore County school system. They recently read Frederick Douglass's narrative. In it, Douglass described a slave owner who forced a female slave to sleep with multiple men so she would reproduce. So people are getting that reminder in many ways. From the evidence that you could find over the centuries, did the attitudes of owners toward the people they owned change over time?
It seems to me that over time, the attitude towards slavery in the South itself changed. In the time of Thomas Jefferson, he had certain moral qualms about the benefit to both white people and black people, both white people and black people about slavery. But by the 1830s, in John C. Calhoun, that had changed to the attitude that slavery was a positive good that God had ordained for Africans in order to make them Christians and learn how to be good workers. And this was the natural order. So that makes a very large difference in the way that you regard people. And of course, there would be different people who had different attitudes depending on. But I think over all time, it was the general convenience of having slaves that ran from colonial period through emancipation, that it was just too difficult for those who benefited from slavery to get rid of slavery.
That's right. In the colonial days, Patrick Henry, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, even Pierce Butler expressed qualms about, even Henry Lawrence, the major slave trader, expressed qualms about the institution of slavery, and they wished they could be rid of it, but they had no choice but to be fabulously wealthy because of it. However, by the 1830s, certainly as the notion that is scholars call paternalism came in, the idea that slavery was God's gift to the world became more and more standard, even as the notion that African Americans were not people became more deeply entrenched among slave owners.
Sharon is calling us from the Eastern Shore. Sharon, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I just wondered if Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin, influenced you at all, or do you take that into account at all?
Well, I certainly read Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin several times when I was growing up. I tended to dismiss her for a long time, as did a lot of other people. But the more I learned about slavery, the more I started to look at her book again. And she gives a great description of what the system was like for those who were sold out of Kentucky and down to the South, which is different than the system was pretty much here in the Chesapeake area for the gathering of slaves and selling them.
And when Uncle Tom's Cabin was challenged, she responded by producing a book called A Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, where she gave real-life sources and models for the things she had cited in the book.
Thank you for your call, Sharon. We are down to just a minute or so left, and I wanted to touch on your thoughts from your coda, the last few pages of this book. You said you were writing during the reaction to Michael Brown's shooting by police officers in Ferguson, during the Baltimore unrest that followed Freddie Gray's death, that you were still putting finishing touches on the text this past summer after the church murders in Charleston. What specific connection can you draw between your research and what we're living now?
It's very hard to do. The coda was the hardest part to write, in part because history doesn't end, so it's hard to end a history book. I think the conclusion is inescapable that the slave breeding industry was a machine for chewing up the black family in every generation, recursively, over and over. And this had the effect. I think the more you look at the historical record, the more you have to be impressed at the strength of the black family, that it could survive this. Black family is very, very strong. But what was systematically denied over and over was the creation of these large family webs that the slave owners were building, these Roman numeraled wealthy people who had wealthy cousins, who had went to wealthy schools where they met other wealthy people and had networks. These kinds of webs were so strong that they did not actually bring the slave owners down when slavery ended. They could start and build their fortunes again with the land they had that was not distributed to the people who had worked it.
We could talk much longer. I want to thank you both, Ned Sublett and his wife Constance Sublett. Their book is The American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry, published by Chicago Review Press. They'll be speaking about the book this evening at 5:30 at the CV Star Center at Washington College in Chestertown. We've got information about that event at the Midday page at WYPR today. Thanks to Ethel's Creole Kitchen for lunch for Midday guests today. And tomorrow on Midday, the Park test scores, what parents should know. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm glad you have been listening and shaping this conversation. Come back again tomorrow.